My name is Roy Malloy, and you are listening to The Dawn of Crime, a podcast dedicated to the biographies for and about people who shaped our history, our culture, our past in dubious, wacky, incredible, and sometimes fascinating ways. This is my first ever podcast where I get to interview someone. I'm pretty thrilled about it. The previous podcasts have all included a huge diversity of criminal activity and being about crimes and trying to find the biographies that made Australia who we are, but the criminal more interesting and fascinating cases. I've not been able to interview anybody yet. This also extends to my own shortcomings with technology, and I've got to admit that if it wasn't for the fact that others are so often willing to help me, I would be yelling this from a street corner rather than podcasting it. So here we are, now being assisted by an incredible person. I am being assisted with the technology of this and being able to interview my first guest is Tansy Bradshaw. Now, Tansy is, I'll let Tansy tell you a little bit about who she is, but Tansy and I have been chatting online for some time about push gangs. Now, if you've never heard of a push gang, you'll be surprised to know how much you probably already know about push gangs. But I'm going to introduce Tansy. Thank you for joining me, Tansy.
No worries at all. Just as a sort of background, I'm Tansy. I'm trained as a library technician, but I do a lot of writing. I also love stand-up and history. This ties into the push gang that I am a person with a disability, and I would prefer to, well, commonly, I like using the word cripple because even though it's not PC for me, I'm claiming it back because I can't specifically describe my disability, but cripple pretty much sums it up.
Okay, and there's a lot of able-bodied people out there that then instantly the knee-jerk reaction is to not know what to say. So you familiarizing that with us and telling us your comfort is a big help. And in discussing push gangs,
yes,
I think one of the things that springs to mind, well, the word gang, and I reckon when I first heard of a push gang, I mistook it for a press gang. Do you know the difference, and could you tell us what the difference is?
Well, from my research and one of the books called Larrikins, The History by Melissa Banter, that goes into like the history of push gangs, but also, as I mentioned, goes on the larrikins. I've got written here, so the term larrikin was first used in the late 1860s, Melbourne, as a way of these poor youths to boast of their flamboyant street credibility. By the 1800s, it had caught up in the mole panic about the out-of-control adolescents who gathered in the loosely comprised street gangs that were referred to as pushers. And larrikinism was also said at the time, it was a scrounge of urban colonial society.
And so in saying all that, the push gang is a group of guys, typically males is what I've gathered. And look, there's probably some social factors that look as why that's more commonly or almost exclusively male. But we're looking at a time period. What kind of time period do you find push gangs?
My particular push gang that I'm looking into was pretty much the main area of focus that I'm looking for is between 1895 and 1905, but there were quite a few gangs, like this is particularly in Melbourne I'm referring to, but there was Sydney, like the Rock Gang, I think it's Rock Push, that's it, and that, but they were mainly around that common time, but there is like even references I found in newspaper articles from like the 1920s that they were kind of starting to fade out, but there was some still around. It just depended
on... The term certainly continued after the actual gangs. And it just become... We get this... I think Band-Aids is a great example where we don't call them sticky plasters. We call them after, we call them what... You know, the predominant brand is what we refer to every brand as, Band-Aids, you know. Here's a fun fact. I don't know if you know this. The female term... For a member of a push gang. Do you know what that is?
No.
A soaker.
Ooh.
And they called them soakers because they were drunk. And so it's as much as anything, it's a slur. And it usually depicted an Irish woman. You get an overlap a little bit historically where they will refer to an Irish soaker and it means a woman. And there's a slur racially there that you know, the Irish are doing nothing but making homebrew and... wouldn't that be a great life, just making homebrew and so then I think your time frame is pretty accurate. You know, it's an 1890s phenomena that comes in, and we also get that, I think, in a lot of ways because there was an economic crash. Do you have it in you to talk much about that?
Well, I don't know much of the economic crash because as far from what I've read, which was like the banks essentially just continued to essentially bust up and that. That kind of leads into my, he ended up being the leader of the gang, Valentine Keating, and Chris, he and his brother were sent to a boys' receiving home after being caught in Melbourne on Collins Street selling matches.
Okay, and so then you're looking at a very, being Keating, he'd be an Irish background, I'm guessing?
Oh, yes, very much.
Now, we're talking to anybody that's listening who isn't aware, we're talking about a backdrop of Melbourne in the mid-1890s, and there's been a huge economic crash. And there was already a working underclass who weren't doing terribly well. To set the scene a little bit, disease is literally everywhere. Influenza, cholera, diphtheria, typhoid, rats, lice, vermin, miasmas of every description, puddles that fester and stink. Every part of daily life was wretched on every single sense. And these people lived among it. After the gold rush, the gold ran out, and all the thousands and thousands of people that came to Melbourne, their children inherited poverty because very few people actually became rich. So the working underclass by the 1890s became exceedingly poor because they were already doing poorly. Now they are really, really poor. So then you got two little boys, the Keating brothers, Irish immigrants. And do you know what area they lived in? Was it Collingwood? Is that...
That's no, it was from... Oh, I can't find where they essentially grew up, but I'm guessing it was around where they ended up forming the, well, Keating ended up forming the gang, so North Melbourne-ish. Yeah. I know Keating was born in Chinatown, so...
Was Chinatown in the same area it is today in that
Yes,
Burke Street area?
Okay. It is, because I also know that the place where... The house essentially where he was born has now currently had to shut down due to COVID. So that
is still intact.
Yeah. It was a seafood restaurant. So again.
Amazing. So he's born in Chinatown, which I'm going to guess isn't probably not a status symbol for the time.
No.
And so he and his brother and their first arrest as young boys. What kind of age are we looking at in these young boys?
When they were caught, it was Thomas, the younger brother, was around, I think, 15, and Keating was around 17 as such. And I noticed, apart from doing, like, ancestry research, but during the time in the boys' receiving home, he actually escaped for a good... 3 to 4 weeks before he got caught again, and then they got discharged to their father the following day.
Okay, so dad's on the scene, which is, you know, I think we all come to every gunfight with our predisposed ideas as to what makes someone the way they are. I didn't imagine that they'd have a present father.
So that's I don't. He's yes, yeah. He's present, but it is noted on the war on the child state ward form that he was known as a drunk, and that so yes, father as such, but not a very productive or settling home life, so to speak.
Yeah, and look, trauma has to feature into this. And do we then start to ask the question, you've got two boys that are heading towards being members of a gang, and at any rate, at any age and any period of time, being in a gang, one would have to imagine that it's not necessarily something somebody does when they've got better choices to make. If they can be more affluent, more refined, educated, comfortable, they don't typically end up in gangs. Do we have any glimpses as to how violence or brutality features in their early lives, or would we just suggest it comes with the poverty they're living in?
I think it would be just the general poverty that it was coming in, and it was particularly because it was just like through reading and stuff, I've learnt that his family was prone to violence, and like the mother got charged with two or three neighbour brawls and stuff, and also at a later point assaulting a police officer.
Whoa, so mum is violent.
Yeah.
And that's like, I don't know many, like I knew my own mum, I know the mum of my children, I gotta say she's falling short on the stakes of assaulting police officers.
Yeah.
In comparison, so brutality and violence is in the home for these guys.
Oh yeah, yeah. And like, I don't know what specifically would have, because the gang that Valentine ended up leading, but was first a member of, was the Crutchy Push. And
before we get to that, yeah? As we draw this journey along,
yeah,
the nature of a push gang, it probably forms a lot like any other gang, and these we see them a lot with boredom. So young men with very little else to do, and certainly no jobs. And that's a very big feature of this, the 1895 to 1905. You get a number of different gangs. A very famous one, I think, that features heavily in Melbourne's history is the Bourke Street Rats. Now, the Bourke Street Rats, they differ from what you're about to talk about because they don't have a hierarchy. Now, the Crutchy Push is a fascinating example because they do have a very clear leader and structure, whereas the Bourke Street Rats are a number of very young pickpockets, but they have chief among them a very young Squizzy and Claude Taylor. So Taylor brothers are a member of this gang, and then they form their own gang. And I think that what I'm about to say will lead into perhaps the structure and beginnings of the Crutchy Push. The Taylor brothers had the Taylor Push, and their gang operated with a hierarchy of Squizzy being in control. And then they franchised to activities that were their own key activities. Things like thumping people for money, making prostitutes give them, you know, a tax, I'll say, a protection tax. But when we look at the Crutchy Push, they differ wildly at a certain point. And can you talk us through what makes them different to either the Bourke Street Rats and different also to the Taylor Push?
Okay, well, first off, a very good thing to know about the Crutchy Push is that apart from being a gang of youths, they all had one leg and were all on crutches. So, what? Yeah. So we essentially have a gang of cripples running Melbourne. They differ from the Bourke Street Rats because apart from thumping people, the Crutchy Push were mainly about getting free food, free grog, and basically creating a somewhat fearsome lay of the land of like, you better do what we say or else.
Now, I'll just ask the question that I think a lot of people will ask. First of all, do you watch South Park?
I have recently only just started watching it, but if you are referring to Timmy...
No, I'm referring to there's a character in one of the episodes, and he's on crutches, and he has a stutter, and he's best friends with Timmy, but he forms a gang called the Crips. Now, the Crips, as we know, are an American, very fierce American gang from the early 2000s, late 90s. But this kid forms the Crips by accidentally killing someone. But all of his gang are crippled.
Yeah.
Now, when we look at these little kids, we think they're not actually capable. And so people think straight away, well, this is a group of people with one leg. Oh, they'd be welfare recipients, if anything, and easily taken advantage of. Is that the case?
Well, this is all basically on from what I have kind of tried to find, and also based on my own experience as a disabled person. When you try and put us down, we are more likely to get angry and fierce. And as there was no welfare at that stage, like the first inclination of the disability support pension, which back then was known as the invalid pension, didn't come into 1908. So there was no support for them. So I think it was a case of banding together to do something because they had no other choice. And I pretty much suspect it may also be, for me, I found when I found my disabled community, it was a case of finding a brother or sister, somebody that you could identify and go, you know exactly how I feel.
Do you feel though, I think there's an assumption there that because these blokes, how many blokes are we talking about with one leg missing or part thereof?
At their peak, which was a few years later, they had around 30 members, half of them being with one leg. And I say half because even though they started off as a disabled gang, it was only during their later years that they actually saw the benefit of having some people with all limbs being able to basically come into it, and they were seen as like honorary members, but at least half.
So the primary trade is fighting or harming others. And so you're looking at 15 guys with part of a leg missing.
Yeah.
Is a person with half a leg missing easily taken advantage of or beaten in a fight?
Well, in reference to the crutchy push, no, because they became quite skilled at standing on one leg and using their crutches as weapons.
Wow, which then has a reach. So my arm, I'm holding it out now, looking at it. My arm, I think that's probably just a little bit longer than half a metre. The length of a crutch to the floor is twice that length, isn't it? So
yeah.
The mechanics of, I guess, whacking someone with a crutch is far greater than my ability to punch him. Do we have any contemporary accounts from that time that talk about their ability to fight with crutches?
Yes, actually. Funny you should say that. Even though this is recounted from a 1953 article, it refers to them, the little clip that I've got says, "The crutch you push was one exception, consisted of one-legged men. The exception was the one-armed man who kept half a brick in his sewn-up sleeve. He led his followers into battle, swinging the weighted sleeve around his head. Behind him came the men on crutches, each one an expert at balancing on one leg. The tip of the crutch was used to jab opponents in the midriff. With the enemy gasping for breath, the crutch would be reversed and the metal shod arm would be used as a club."
God.
Yeah.
Just extraordinary. It's beyond anything we can really imagine. So let's paint a scene. Do we have any descriptions of scenes of these battles?
Not specifically scenes, like they kind of go that they were basically violent, and they used their, the most vivid one is the one that I just had read, but there is reference to them beating policemen and other officers down. And I should actually mention it now that even though the gang was mostly made up of men, Valentine's girlfriend, Harriet Adderley, was actually known being very violent herself and would join in with the brawls. So we also have a female in there and known for kicking, belting and all that. It was mainly, they would talk about, like, in the newspapers I found, they talk about, like, yeah, they use their crutches, but not give any, like, descriptions of, like, belting them or that, just basically like you would read in a newspaper article. But what I kind of found interesting was that they would more or less refer to when they actually escaped and their movements of actually moving away.
It would conjure a picture of a very gradual escape. I mean, these guys are on crutches, yeah?
No, actually. They were referred to, one police officer, I'm paraphrasing, but the quote was, he ran away like a hopping kangaroo, except with crutches.
So that speaks of the speed as well as the physical description, doesn't it?
Yeah, they were from, and again, this is from my experience, when you would be, let's say, lack of an arm, like my disability, I've got only use of one hand properly. And in my years on this earth, I have managed to navigate this world with one hand that I can basically do 99% of things. And it's the same back then with having one leg, you would find a way to be able to get the fastest speed and with practice to get up the momentum to be exactly alongside someone that had two legs, for example.
And it's particularly if you had a leg missing or part of a leg from a younger age. And in this, in the crutchy push, we have a pretty clear sense of hierarchy too, don't we?
Yes. There is. Valentine Keating became leader in 1901 when the previous leader, a guy by the name of George Reginald Hill, was actually killed in a murderous assault by a fellow gang leader that was eventually thrown out because it couldn't be proven. But that just goes to show that the gang weren't necessarily just violent with people that they would see in the world, but within the gang themselves.
Did Hill have a disability?
Yes, they all had disabilities at that stage. And from what I can see, Hill had the one leg missing as well. Okay. And so did the guy that, David Welsh, who was actually one of Valentine's really good friends, ended up being charged and, like I said, it thrown out. But it was still that violent nature of these were, again, all men. I don't honestly know whether it would be vying for competition, but from the court transcripts, actually, now I remember, it was basically the fight that ended up causing his death was at a pub that started over a comment that was made by David about that he could steal Reg's girlfriend off him.
Yeah. Oh, that old chestnut.
Oh, yeah, that old chestnut, because, of course, that's a way to, you know, get things moving.
And the staggering now in this modern era of comfort and safety to think that many people had pieces of limbs missing. But I'll reference my own grandfather, my mother's father. He had two hands, obviously, but parts of each hand were missing. He'd lost the ends of two fingers. His index and middle finger were cut off on the belt and wheel of a factory that he worked at in North Fitzroy in early 1920s. And then he, later in life in the 1950s, he'd said to my mum when she was about seven, he had his head under the bonnet of the car, and he said, when I tell you to start the engine, start the engine. She heard start the engine, so she didn't. It cut off the end of the other middle finger. And so I remember a lot of his friends were also missing bits of digits. Their safety is such a modern thing, isn't it?
Yes.
And so as we follow the story of a push member, we could follow the career and time and life of Squizzy Taylor or Claude Taylor to see what becomes of members of push gangs. Some would come good, some would, you know, settle down and have normal lives, I guess, but you know, Squizzy Taylor certainly didn't. What became of Valentine Keating?
Well, it depends on which era, and I say which era, like
Was he present in a push gang? What was his push gang years?
Mainly between 1895 and 1905, and that only stopped because it was in September of 1904 that him, another gang member by the name of John Collins and Harriet Adderley were all charged with a murderous assault on a police constable, and given the men were given 5 years jail and Harriet was given a 1 year jail sentence.
Now, in my very cursory reading, which doesn't come close to yours, I guess, is this the copper who stands in the docks in court saying, and I'm still picking bits of skull out of my head?
I'm pretty sure it's that one, yes.
He copped the underarm piece of a crutch, which wasn't padded. I've had crutches once and they were padded. He copped the hard metal-shaped end of a crutch to the head.
Yes. Yeah, that would be that one. So, yeah, it basically, there is no reference of the crutchy push between those years.
So Valentine Keating, the crutchy push, loses momentum swiftly.
Oh yes, like there is, because of course I've looked at the other members and there is bits and pieces, but nothing to the big kind of what they were. Like they were getting frequent write-ups in the paper, frequent mentions in the police gazettes from warrants that were
out. So having gone to jail,
yes,
Keating, he'd have a mugshot.
Yes.
Okay, well, I'll use that. I'll find his mugshot and I'll get that from you. I'll use it as the thumbnail for this podcast when you're looking at the index, so you can get a look at what he looks like. What becomes of him after jail? So 1905 we're now looking at. Or is it 1909?
He came out in 1909 and there isn't much really from him for a few years. I haven't found any references of the gang. There is a mention of the crutchy push in 1912, but that doesn't specifically mention Valentine Keating. And it was noted that, I guess, in the time that he was in jail, while the crutchy push were there, they kind of regenerated into this new kind of found push gang that had members that would not be so brutal towards police, and were known for running away and being, I guess, scared of the police, whereas prior to that with Valentine, they would have stood their ground.
Okay. Do we see then perhaps, look, this is sociology that would require a pretty good knowledge of statistics, but do we see a link between the economy getting better, society getting more comfortable, versus Valentine Keating's own upbringing where things weren't comfortable? So there's that poverty equals brutality, and then the next generation, they've got it a bit easier. They're not as violent.
There is a bit of that. There is also, I don't know the exact details, but I know that because I think it was like a program or something that was established to basically get men like Valentine out of these push gangs and to essentially make them useful, for want of a better word.
Okay, how did he become useful?
He didn't.
okay.
He didn't. He was, from what I've researched, he was out of the newspapers. I can't find any trace of him until 1916, when he is charged with selling sly grog, which...
Okay, so for those of you in America who listen to this show, and I've got a couple of you, sly grog is what you call bootleg. It's homemade booze. Now, interestingly, the Irish, particularly around North Melbourne, where the Crutchy Push find their stomping ground, pardon the pun, they were making prolific and huge quantities of ale. Ale, of course, is made from the wheat and the yeast we make bread from, and it's perfected by the Irish immigrants. So it makes perfect sense that that's what he's doing. Do we have any idea as to how is he making it to sell to others, or is he running his own sly grog shop?
Well, interestingly, it's kind of, he was running his own sly grog shop. However, again, from research I've done and from talking to Melbourne historian Michael Salford, who does the Melbourne crime historic tours.
Incredible mind.
Yes. He was actually, Valentine actually worked under Ted Whiting. And Ted Whiting was in direct competition with Sly Grog against Squizzy Taylor.
Ted Whiting was also an incredibly dangerous man.
Title-winning
boxer.
Yes.
He was a title-winning boxer who was able to box but wasn't afraid of using a variety of other methods of violence to achieve his ends. Wasn't aware that Keating overlapped there.
Yeah, that's one thing that I was quite surprised at myself, because I knew basically, I knew the times match, but it wasn't until I talked to Michael and did a walk around one of his historical tours that he actually said, yeah, he was actually in with Ted and actually helped them. He at that stage, he lived around the corner from Ted Whiting's main establishment.
Okay. And so then we're also then drawing this to, I think, one of the most famous golden era 1920s incidences, which is the Fitzroy Vendetta. The Fitzroy Vendetta begins with Squizzy Taylor and Ted Whiting's. It's an interaction which, in Australian culture, comparing to American culture, is like the Valentine's Day massacre, but on a far smaller scale. But it does ramp up to a gang war.
Yes.
That implicates the Crutchy Push in really one of Australia's most key moments of that golden era. What becomes of Valentine Keating in his, how does he end his life? Where do we end up with that?
Okay, so after two charges, like I mentioned, in 1916 and 1919, on the sly grog charge, which was 2 6-month jail stints, he did marry a woman called Ivy Glenn in 1922 after Harriet Adderley had actually died of the pre-pandemic to COVID, the Spanish flu. So, again, drawing parallels, but between 1922 and when he died in 1930, there are three references I found to Valentine Keating. He was brought up on charge again with Sligrog, but this time in a receiving stolen goods charge in 1925.
Okay, but Sligrog is in actually stolen booze at that
point. Yeah, as in actually someone was giving him stolen booze, but that was dismissed. He was arrested in 1927 after riotous behaviour at a party. And just...
And riotous behaviour, could you describe what that means?
Basically being young, or at this stage he was in his 40s, obnoxious, yelling, basically doing anything that would cause, I guess, a disturbance in the neighbourhood.
Would it be fighting?
Yeah, and a little bit of that too, I'm pretty sure. And the final, the final mention as far as his criminal activities was when he was found drunk behind a front seat of a car in 1929.
Driving a car?
Yeah, which, as I was thinking before this, brings up a few, well, one particular question, because... as I have mentioned, he has one leg and you have to do the accelerator and the brake. And I'm not sure how, if anything, he would drive. Because
I'm thinking about it myself as you say that.
Yeah.
I drive a stick shift and I don't. Did he have the option of a prosthetic?
No. And I know from mentioning... Adam Hills, who has a false leg, and knowing how he describes his driving, I very much doubt that Valentine Keating would have been driving. So whether he was just drunk and found his car and basically fell asleep in it. But the fact that he was found in the front seat leaves a lot of questions.
It's extraordinary. It's quite amazing. When does he die?
He dies in 1930 of tuberculosis at the age of 50.
Gosh, the parallels just keep coming back to this COVID lockdown, don't they?
Oh, it does. And, well, even though it's a very long bode, but I'm very much one for drawing it, TB is what we commonly know tuberculosis as, but that's also my initials.
Gosh, what fantastic initials to have under the given circumstances. Do we know if Keating has any surviving family? Did he have children?
With Ivy, he did. There is record that he did have one child with Ivy, which, again, I've done down the ancestry and found relatives that may be still living today, but I'm not sure. And one thing I haven't mentioned is after Valentine just became leader, so this is like back in 1901, he actually had a child with Harriet Adderley that died at 9 weeks old.
It's tragic but common too, isn't it, for that era?
It is, because actually he also had sisters, but he had one brother and one sister that also died in childbirth as well. So it was a very common thing at that stage for, like, anybody to live, and then after, with all the diseases going around, it would be absolutely a cesspit of just trying to survive against the toughest.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tansy, I want to thank you for joining us. This has been absolutely fascinating on so many levels. I've learnt lots, I've got to be honest, and it's shaped a huge amount of what I've known about gangs in general. Never been a member of one. Always wanted to, but not the aggressive hitting people with clubs that were formerly crutches kind, but more the, you know, secret handshake kind of gang. Maybe we can start our own. But ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to The Dawn of Crime. My guest has been Tansy Bradshaw. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you enjoyed the pod.